Blog
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura Mize and Kate Hensler. I am Laura Mize, pediatric speech and language pathologist.
And I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist with the First Steps program here in Louisville, Kentucky.
And we'd like to welcome you to our show today. I had a new little script to do, and I still didn't do it right, even if when I was looking at the words, so sorry about that. It's Thursday, August 13th. It's 2 o'clock Eastern time, and if you're listening now, you're listening live, and we would love to have you call in our show today. I want to go ahead and give you that number. It's 1-718-766-4332, and if you have any question at all about your toddler or your young child's speech-language development, we would love to hear from you. We do have a regular topic today, though, an established topic, and maybe Kate and I will do our best to stay on track, but even if your question is off what we're talking about, we'd love to hear from you. We're going to continue our discussion today about childhood apraxia, and we've been talking about that for several weeks now. In the previous shows, we've identified what those characteristics are. We've talked about how apraxia differs from phonological disorder, which is kind of the diagnosis that speech pathologists kind of hedge on. You know, is it a phonological disorder or is it apraxia? So that's why we're sort of talking about these together, because there are so many similarities. And then last week we started talking about successful treatment strategies, and we sort of talked about kind of our overall treatment philosophy for treating children with apraxia, and that is you have to be fun and playful and get them hyped up a little bit, but still require them to respond, whether that be with a sign or a word or a vocalization or anything communicative. But the foundational piece of that is that we work really hard to, first of all, physically get kids ready to talk in that heightened emotional state, as Kate likes to say, and then we make them motivated so that they want to participate and want to talk. But then after, as soon as I say something like that, I think, but there are always kids that you get them there and then still nothing, no sounds, no words, no peep, not a vocalization at all. So we're going to talk about today starting with a kid like that for children who are truly nonverbal, the kinds of strategies that we use in our therapy sessions. And again, we work with young children. Babies, toddlers, kids up to three. I see some kids after three, but usually those are children that I've worked with within our state's early intervention program, so I'm pretty aware that I hardly ever start a child on my caseload that's after three. And then, you know, so these are techniques for very, very young children, and want to just kind of preface our conversation by saying that.
And it's Kate, really I was just going to add that, and you kind of said this, but on that quiet note, it's very common when we get initial referral and go to do an assessment that we hear moms and dads routinely say, he's really quiet, and or he, you know, and we typically ask, well, how about when he was a baby? How about when he was 12 months or 18 months, you know, because we get a lot of kids at 2 or right around there, and it's very common to hear them say, no, he never really babbled. No, you know, he was very easy, very quiet. They compare him, if they have other kids, to those kids, and apraxic kids, they tend to be very quiet kids. I mean, they can cry and they can yell, perhaps, but they don't babble. You know, they're not doing the goo-goo gaga thing that most typically developing babies are. So, quiet.
Right, and some parents are kind of misled by that because they think, oh, he's so good. Boy, he was a good baby. He never made a peep. And Kate and I always joke about and say, well, that's not so good in our book.
Yeah.
Because babies are supposed to be vocal and supposed to be a little demanding and use those even before they're using words. They should be using, you know, kind of a scream when you want them or when they want you to come to them or even when they're reaching for something and, you know, a little vocalization that would be a precursor to words to let you know that, you know, they're trying to communicate. So that is a red flag when we hear that in a child's history. I don't think pediatricians pay enough attention to that either, or they sometimes don't know the right questions to ask.
I totally agree. Yeah, they tend to look at 2 years, when, you know, they're doing the two-year well baby check, and they say, how many words does he have? And that's an obvious question, but for a kid who really doesn't vocalize to speak of at all, you know, I have a lot of moms say, one, you know,
yeah.
None, you know, and it's kind of, in our minds, a little late in the game to be addressing how many sounds, how many words at two, but that's, you know, that seems to be when the big word question. I think perhaps they ask it at 18 months, but then they say, don't worry, you know.
He's a boy. Boys talk later. Don't. It's okay. I've had a lot of kids not talk between 18 months and two, and that certainly can happen. But I think if they probed a little bit and the pediatrician asked a question like, well, does he ever make noise? And if a mom said, no, he's really quiet, I only really hear his voice if he's crying or maybe squealing, then I think more pediatricians would take notice.
Well,
maybe.
Mara, you and I have shared a case or two where the pediatrician has also been the mother of a late talker, and then
right.
They become really, you know, keyed into that when it's their child, and then they turn around in their practices and start asking those more probing questions and say
right.
stuff like that. Well, you know, is he using gestures? Is he vocalizing to express his feelings? Is he, you know, because then they become aware, oh, it really is important before too. But I think
right.
unless it's one of those parents, doctor mommies who are doctor daddies who's, you know, been on the other side of it, they don't really recognize sometimes that's important, what they do before, too.
Well, you know, and I have a lot of physicians' children on my caseload at any time, and those kids get referred really early, too.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot of doctor's kids between 15 and 18 months
mm-hmm.
because it's not so easy when you're the mom and
mm-hmm.
you're thinking, oh, boy, we didn't make those 12-month communication milestones. Okay, here it is 15 months. We didn't make those 15-month communicated milestones. And then I think because it's their own child, they do start to get a little bit more concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a lot of referrals in the last couple of years of physicians' children. But sometimes even with a doctor, they kind of wait. We've had a later one, that little guy that we had whose mom was a physician, that was a little bit later referral.
Mm-hmm.
That was close to two, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it can happen either way. So we're going to talk today, though, about what you do if you do have those children who barely are making a peep. And I feel like all these shows about apraxia, I spend the first 20 minutes kind of reviewing what the signs are. I'm not going to do that again today, but I am going to talk just for 1 minute and 1 minute only about what has to come first before you really start to work on these words and these early sounds, because if a child is not interacting with you, that's what you need to target first. Talking for that kind of child really is something you look at later after you've established that good social interaction piece. And by that, we mean that they want to play with you. They are giggly with you. They're looking at you, and their little eyes are twinkling, and they're so connected, and they're not just over in the corner doing their own thing. Or they're not just coming to you only when they're distressed, or it's not all about you reading their signals all the time. You know, you want to make that, you want to be sure that you're establishing that your child has that social connection before you would even begin to think about him talking. And then the next piece of that is that your child understands some language and understands some words. And, you know, a lot of times we work on language and work on words and signs and these things before a child's receptive language or what he understands is completely age appropriate. But if he isn't recognizing words and making associations and following some directions, we would again want to work on that first and as the most important piece of therapy before we started working on the things that we're about to say here. Is there anything you want to add to that, Kate?
No, because then we'll spend 20 minutes going over the thing.
I know.
I think it's important to make that note, but,
yeah,
you know, assuming yeah. that that's the case or you're working on that, then what do you do? The primary topic for today is what do you do with that really very, very, very quiet child
right.
who doesn't seem to understand or isn't able to imitate.
Right, imitate some sounds. Okay, and then before we do that, we've got a caller. So let's go ahead and take our caller.
Oh, yay.
Hi, caller. Are you there?
What's good, man?
Hello?
Yo, what's good?
Okay, do you have a question?
It was good. It's more Ricky Rouse sitting in the cut.
Okay. I'm not sure that that's a legitimate caller.
I think so.
And we don't have our usual person who's helping us today with the switchboard. So I'm just going to, okay, there. I think it's off now. Sorry about that. We don't ever know what we're going to get. All right. So we are going to start talking about specifically what we do when a child is nonverbal and is very, very quiet. And let me just start, too, by saying there's no magic wand. And even with these techniques, it's not always happening in the first 5 minutes that we introduce some of these. And sometimes one or two of these work, and sometimes we're through this whole darn list and we still haven't heard tons of things. So, again, when you're listening to this, please don't think that there's some kind of special pixie dust that we're sprinkling as we do these things. You know, these things work, and these are the things we try first. But, again, let me say that it's not magic. I mean, and it does involve some commitment on a parent's part or on a therapist's part to implement these things and kind of get them going. But everything we're going to talk about today can be done in the context of play, too. You would never, you know, put your baby really in the high chair and strap him in or at a table and say, okay, today we're going to do this stuff and learn how to talk. You know, all of these things, even as we talk about the specific things that we do, are done with toddlers and babies on the floor in the context of playing with them. And it's not where you're just going to go in and all of a sudden, you know, grab them up from their beds and start to do this. Again, it all involves play. And the reason that we do that is because when a child is interacting and having fun, he's much more likely to verbalize, and that could be sometimes on purpose and sometimes it's even not on purpose. He kind of does it reflexively. These kinds of things happen. And I would think with a kid, one of the first things that I would try, Kate, is just something, some fun thing that we were talking about like last week with bouncing the ball or doing bubbles or even a game of chase or roughhousing where we really want to elicit giggles and squeals and laughs and any kind of little sound in that context. And, again, when I'm thinking about working with a nonverbal kid, I want to get words, but more than anything, I want to make him noisy before we even start. And movement is the very best way to do that. And, you know, with typically developing babies, we start to see them babble and hear them start to make a lot of noise sometimes when they're swinging or when they're riding in the car or when they're in their crib kind of jumping up and down a little bit, you know, holding onto the handrail and bouncing a little bit, and that's when you might start to hear mama, 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 da-da-da-da-da, you know, when they're really kind of moving. So that's one thing that we would want to duplicate in a therapy session is really moving around and, again, kind of getting their little systems up and going and having a lot of fun. Rarely do I see a truly nonverbal kid pop out a first word or a first really kind of consistent vocalization when we're sitting down in one place. Do you agree with that, Kate?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I always liken it to think of when kids are the loudest outside on the playground, you know, when they're running, they're jumping, and they're squealing, and they're having fun. And it's the same thing with kids, even though rarely do I find myself on a playground with one of the children that I see, but we just kind of make the family room the playground of the moment and try and get some movement in there, and that's your best effort for getting them to vocalize at all.
Right. And that can, you know, and I try to pick what a kid likes. If a mom says that he's a jumper boy, I get him up on the couch and let him jump down on the floor or jump down in my arms, and we do that. If a mom says that he likes to run, boy, especially I love those houses where they have the big loops, you know, where the den loops into the kitchen and then it loops into a hall and then you can kind of make a big circle out of it, you know, we might play chase. If a mom tells me that it's a kid that really likes to roughhouse, boy, I pick him up and slam him down on the couch a few times. You know, again, all in a playful kind of manner. but you're still wanting to get them really, really playing and really with you and connected. And, again, you're going to want to hear some of those laughs. You know, I've had a couple of children on my caseload, though, that when I start to really ask a mom early on, they don't even make a sound when they laugh. And you've had those, too, haven't
mm-hmm.
you, Kate?
Oh, yeah. A couple.
Okay, I had to swallow today. I'm trying to eat as we do the show, too. Sorry about that. No lunch. But that's something, too, and that's something that I've really, when I start to kind of think about apraxia, that, you know, just from a parent history, from my mom telling me things, that's something that I've started really asking, you know, when he cries, does he really make a sound? Or when he laughs, does she, you know, laugh out loud? Are you hearing those? Because occasionally you'll get a kid that doesn't even do that. Mm-hmm. Or if I have a kid that I'm doing all that roughhousing and doing all the really running and jumping and I'm hooping and hollering and, you know, making all kinds of noise and they're not doing anything, that's when I think, uh-oh, boy, this is going to be a long process, you know, when we can't even get it kind of reflexively
mm-hmm.
like that. So that's something we do. We talked about this game on the when we did the series on toys in the fall, but a game that I have a good luck with kids getting them to make noise is that elephant game.
Yeah.
You know, and that's for those of you who haven't listened before or don't know what that toy is. Kate, do you want to describe that while I take another bite or two?
Sure. It is a bat whip. Breaking one of our rules, battery operated, but it is not a bells and whistles toy. It is a battery operated, call it a base that looks like an elephant, and then it has a long plastic flexible snout or trunk that comes out of the base. And it has little, like, parachute cloth butterflies, and they go inside, and you turn it on, and the nose shoots up, and the butterflies shoot out, and they have comes with four nets, and the object is to catch them. A lot of the times when I work with youth, I have that, and kids love it, but a lot of the kids we see aren't necessarily, don't have the eye-hand coordination to actually catch them very much, but it doesn't really matter. What they like is that they're shooting out of the nose, and it's funny, and it's, you know, we try and catch them and load them back up and do it again. It's just a lot of action and really kind of exciting. Most kids, it's funny because it's such a familiar toy to me, but even older siblings, lots of times that I work with have never seen it. And it's really exciting. You know, things flying through the air in the family room just isn't an everyday occurrence. So it's really kind of
right.
Gets their interest in whether they catch them or not. It's kind of funny sometimes to watch kids try and catch them because
it is.
They don't necessarily catch. If they do, it's a fluke. Let's put it that way. I have very few kids who actually move the net to catch them, but they try, and they don't care. Lots of times I catch them and dump them in their net, and they're just as happy whether they caught them or not. So
they are, and the whole point of all of these kinds of games and activities is that you are making noise. You know, and not necessarily all words, you know, sounds like wee and whoa and ooh. You know, you're vocalizing the whole time and really, again, trying to get them to do it. And another great technique that you can do during this is any sound that they make, you try to copy exactly the same sound. The fancy name for that is vocal synchrony. It's in Pamela Marcella's great book about childhood apraxia. The name of that book is Becoming Verbal with Childhood Apraxia. It's an easy, easy read. It's, oh gosh, it's really cheap. It's like $12 or $15. I think you can still get it on Amazon. And that's what she calls it, vocal synchrony. And again, the point is that you want to match with what exact sound they're using. Sometimes kids make a sound and I think, I don't even know what that was. I don't even know if I can do that sound. And boy, when I really put my professional speech pathologist hat on and try to transcribe it and think, how do I write that? What is that? What was that? But, you know, you do try to match it, and you want to really try to match it in the sound. You want to try to match it in the pitch, you know, whether it's a high pitch or a low pitch. You want to try to match it in the length, whether they do it really short or whether they make it really long. You want to try to match the same volume, so if they're loud or soft. So if they try to do a sound or make a sound, you imitate them. And I don't usually just, I mean, sometimes kids notice right away when you do that, but usually it takes a pretty long time, you know, when you're in the rhythm and playing like that. And then I love it when a kid finally realizes that I'm doing that, because then you can almost see their wheels turning, and then they almost look like, is she going to do it? Is she going to, you know, is she going to do that? But again, that's with a child who really is probably no cognitive challenges, no receptive language issues. You know, kids have to be pretty on the ball, I think, to recognize that you're copying them.
Right, and Pamela, I like that book too because it's really easy to read but very directed on apraxia. But one of her things is to get as close to them as possible, so you are really kind of making it as obvious as possible that, you know, not that you always have to be totally in their face, but to the extent that they tolerate that and you're able to pull that off, to be real close to them. So if they go, ooh, and you go, ooh, and you're right there, as opposed to across the room, they might not really catch that you're oohing right after they ooh. So if you kind of exaggerate your distance or your, maybe not exaggerate, if you restrict your distance from them, it's going to be a little bit more obvious. And I think the whole rationale with imitate them is these are kids who don't imitate. You know, they don't, most babies do that. You know, mommy says, ma, 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 and 12-month-old daughter says, ma, 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 whether she
or earlier than that, you know,
right,
between 6 and 9 months, yeah.
They, you know, that's really pretty easy for a typically developing child. Even before they know that mama means mama, they can imitate mommy when she makes those sounds, and most parents clue into that and spend lots of time doing that, and baby learns, hey, you know, she says ball, I can say ball too. But apraxic kids don't have that ability to just automatically imitate things, and I'm assuming it's Dr. Marcella, but Pamela Marcella thinks that if you spend time imitating them, it helps them to learn how to imitate.
Right.
Because there's no real obvious way that I'm aware of other than perhaps that. How are you going to teach a kid to imitate who can't get those sounds out? You know, kids just normally do that. You don't really teach it. It just is part of typical language development. But for apraxic kids, it's almost undoubtedly a piece they don't have. So,
right.
Yeah. So
otherwise, they would have kicked in and started imitating, and we wouldn't be two without any words.
Right.
You know, back to the, I have 2 points about that. You brought up some great things. First of all, sometimes you really do have to teach kids how to imitate anything, and if you have a kid who's nonverbal and they don't really start to try to imitate sounds, and I realize, oh, gosh, he doesn't imitate anything. He can't even imitate movements. Then you back up and work on them imitating any kind of movement. And how I do that is the same way that we've just talked about. If they make a movement, I try to copy it. Remember when we were working with our cute little girl that had Rett syndrome,
mm-hmm.
Kate, and we worked with her on that, and we started with like when she was in her little playhouse or when she, even anything kind of non-purposefully that she did, if it was a motion that we thought would catch her attention, you know, if she took a little hat or a plastic purse and just kind of put it up in the air and down, you know, we would grab it and, you know, do the same thing, just kind of imitate her little motion in play. If a kid pounds on, you know, takes little hands and pats the floor or pats the window, you know, I would do that. I would get right in their little faces and right in their little space and, you know, pat the window back when they've done that and try to turn that into an imitation game. When they clap, you know, often kids will clap, you know, when we're doing the whole yay piece. You know, I try to sometimes wait till they clap and then I clap after them. You know, any little motor motion that they might do, or not little motion, I usually try to pick things that are pretty big, but I try to make it pretty obvious that I'm imitating what they're doing. And again, sometimes you have to work on that for a while before they're even sort of ready to start to imitate verbally,
right,
what you do. And the other thing I wanted to say, when you were talking about being close to a kid, one thing that I try to do too with those kids, if they'll let me and if they like it, is bounce them on my lap and really, you know, while I'm sitting on the floor, stick my legs straight out in front of me and then put them on my legs and bounce them and play with them. Usually you can do it with a little social game, a little song, excuse me, like row row your boat or ride a little horsey, or any just little silly thing that you make up, you know, up, 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 down. I think that little game is on Teach Me to Listen and Obey 1 that I play with my little friend Abby. And any little game like that is so great because, one, you're getting to move them, so they've got the movement piece there, and they're right in front of you. And you will have kids sometimes look away and you know, or wiggle out, not want to do it. But for the most part, if you are fun enough and if you are doing something, you know, you've really got your thinking cap on and you're trying to come up with something that they like, you can usually hold their attention for a little while when they're right there. And that's a great time to bounce them, to swing them back and forth, you know, any kind of, you know, move your legs and let them fall on the floor real fast. And any kind of little motion right there, you're almost always going to get a laugh out of that. And then, again, try to imitate how they laugh. Try to imitate any little sound they do. I'll lift kids up to up, 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 up. And then if we're not even sort of ready to work on words, you know, you might just do, you know, whoa, when you're about to drop them, or boom, or any little sound like that. You know, you can do with that, or any sound that they make in that process. If they do a big, you know, surprise thing, imitate that. Use what they have and use what sounds they're giving you in that context. But I do like to have kids on my lap right there. Do you do that?
Depending on the child, Laura, like you said, some kids take to it immediately. Kind of depends where they are on the social stuff. You know, if they're pretty social kids, they tend to really like it. If they're not, sometimes it takes me a while to get them there because they're not really comfortable being that close, you know, and in my face, kind of like that. But I try and make myself do it because it is very effective. So, yeah.
It is pretty effective. You know, and there's the new Apraxia DVD that I hope is going to be out within the next week. Oh, I hope. There's a section where I have a little girl that I'm bouncing her on my lap, and she's a little girl with real low arousal. And by that, I mean, boy, it took a lot to get her going. You know, she was a kid that was pretty, looked pretty somber all the time. She didn't really smile a lot. And so when you looked at her, you know, you're always thinking, oh, boy, does she even like me? You know, is she even sort of paying attention to what we're doing? But it wasn't really that. It was just she's so low arousal. It took a lot to really get her going and get her to even smile or laugh or demonstrate any kind of expression with her face. Or, you know, she's, I think you call kids like this, Kate, sometimes you'll say he was a lump today. He was a little lump. He just kind of sat there.
I would never say that. Yes, that's my loving term for, and really low arousal would probably be more appropriate. But, yeah, I'll say, ooh, he's lumpy. Woo.
Mm-hmm.
Really got to get their motors running. I do a lot of tickling with those kids. Those kids,
yeah,
they need a lot. You know, they need that feedback, and somehow tickling. I play my get 'em game a lot with that because then they're moving and I'm moving and I'm tickling them, and that tends to get them wound up appropriately so they're ready to make some noise.
Yeah, and during that, you know, if they squeal, you squeal. If they laugh, you laugh. If they giggle, if they do a surprise kind of. You know, you do that. Just imitate any little sound that they give you with that. Back to bouncing kids on my lap, I do a lot of having them clap. And if they aren't imitating me clapping, boy, you can take their little hands and make them clap when they're right there. You can do the whole, yay, and, you know, lift their arms up in the air when you're doing that. And, again, because you have them in such close proximity, those are things that are easier to do. Some kids really like that whole building a tent thing, like being under a table. Some moms, you know, are more open to that at home, you know, when I'm there for visits than other moms. But that's something that you might try the next time that your kid's under a table or under something, crawl in there with them. And, you know, the good thing about being that close and in that tight of space is sometimes it sounds almost echoey.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really do some ooh and ee, you know, some vowels and things and make some sounds. Older kids or kids, again, that are apraxic that don't have the whole receptive language or understanding piece, and you could probably, if you made it dark and took a flashlight in there, that would be a lot of fun, you know, to do the whole wow and oh, and again, just making those kinds of sounds and imitate any sound that your kid would give you too.
You know, Laura, don't you find that the kids you see generally, even really kids who have some cognitive impairment, whose receptive skills aren't at age level, you may suspect that apraxia is also part of it, but in any case, that they really, really like when you imitate them. I don't think that that's something they experience too much. I think that
right.
toddlers are typically encouraged to imitate mommy, imitate daddy, imitate big brother, you know, do it like him, do it like me, and not too many people spend much time really doing it the way they do it. And
right.
even that little girl you referred to, I remember as we began to do those things, that was kind of when her little social spark started to come out, remember?
It was, yes.
Mm-hmm. That was when she kind of looked back and thought, okay, I'm not sure I understand you completely, but you're kind of funny. I kind of like that you're following me around the room and doing everything I do. And you could see she was on some level anyway, maybe not completely aware, but somewhat aware that, you know, these
right.
ladies are spending their time doing what I'm doing. And that really kind of seemed to tickle her. And after that, she really did kind of engage more routinely socially.
She did.
And yeah, she did. That was kind of when we both kind of said, well, you know.
I think we're getting somewhere here. Yeah.
That and might be the ticket. Yeah, that
yeah,
was.
And again, she was really, really delayed across the board. And because of just the nature of her diagnosis, will be delayed for a long, long time. But even on that kind of very basic level, she got that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is something that I think is really effective, even
right.
for kids that
they
are
really
lower.
Seem to think it's funny, and they like
yeah.
being the leader, even if they didn't
right.
choose to be the leader. They kind of go, you know, you'll do what I do? All right, we might be able to communicate somehow, you know. So
yeah, and especially
– Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it also helps with the social piece, you know, for those kids who that's not a strong suit or they, you know, that may be something that isn't easy for them. I've had a lot of those kids who kind of get the twinkle at that point. When you begin to do what they do, they really light up and kind of you build that very important social connection. So anyway, sorry, Laura.
Well,
you go ahead.
Especially for the kids who don't have the cognitive delays or the receptive language delays, like I said, you can see their wheels turning. You can see them thinking,
mm-hmm.
oh, my gosh, she did it. Let's see if she'll do this one. You know, it becomes very fun for them and they get really engaged because it is like they're thinking, I cannot believe that she's doing exactly what I do. And so it's a lot of fun kind of across the board for that. The other technique that Pamela Marcello recommends for children at this level is to do what's called vocal contagion, and that's where, and it would work best probably not just with mom and a baby, but maybe mom and a toddler and your older kids or, you know, some other kids. And what you're going to do there is you all are doing the same kind of play activity. And in the book, she talks about having babies. And what you might do with the babies is everybody, you know, has a doll, and you're all feeding the baby. And you were just really focused on doing sounds and maybe just single words or short phrases. So you're not going to launch into a big narrative about, oh, look, mommy's going to brush this baby's pretty blonde hair right now. If you're brushing the baby's hair, you're going to, you know, say, baby, ooh, brush, brush, ooh, hair, brush, brush, I brush hair, and really make some noises and really do some little sound effects and keep it short and sweet. And again, you're not kind of really waiting on kids to take turns during this time. Everybody's just kind of doing their own thing, but you're all right there together. And the theory behind this is, vocal contagion is contagious. They're going to want to say something or somehow contribute verbally or make a noise that you're making. I think this works great when you're working with baby dolls and you're pretending to feed them because you're doing or or num 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 or, you know, lots of little, you can make all kinds of little play sounds you can make during play that are like you're playing. Kate, you like to fake cry a lot with babies, you know, when you're brushing their hair and you pretend like the brush is stuck. Ow! You know, oh no, stuck. And then you do the whole fake cry bit. You know, that would be a fun thing to do because again, kids really like that and they really get into it and they're she feels like they're freer at that point, because everybody's vocalizing, everybody's talking to kind of start to make some noise. And she talks about how effective that is kind of in a group therapy situation. And I know when I had my little play group, the language-based play group program that we had, we tried to do that a lot where everybody's playing the same thing and where the adults are really modeling sound effects that accompany the play, simple words that accompany it, but you're not, again, not really waiting on that whole taking turns piece. You just want everybody there kind of being a little bit loud and doing it all so that you entice those kids to kind of join in.
Right. And you could do that like using elephant, or you could do that playing with balloons, or you could do that doing bubbles, or, you know, any kind of group activity where there's really no set rules or structure, just noise, you know, just making sounds that, you know, encourages. And I think the movement part of doing the bubbles, you know, running and popping them or trying to catch the butterflies from elephant would also play into that and just encourage them to vocalize that much more. If you have other kids who are able to imitate what you're doing, and, you know, any child past two and a half would probably fit the bill. Probably older kids would maybe understand it a little more, but say a play.
They would, and you, yeah, and you could tell them, you could say, listen, we're not going to really do a whole lot of talking right here. We're just going to say things that baby brother or baby sister might try to say after us. So what you want to do is just say one word at a time, or you just want to do some sounds, or like when mommy does it, you try to do it after me, and let's get really noisy. And I think siblings that are 5 or 6 are ideal for that,
right,
because you can instruct them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that 3-year-old range, that's kind of hard, because sometimes those kids can't really understand what you're trying to get them to do. But an older sibling, that early school age, is perfect for that kind of play.
Right. 'Cause
you can tell them what to do.
Or even having a bunch of little Hot Wheels cars at a table and having kids at, you know, the four at sides of the table and taking them and winging them across the table, or crashing them or booming them or vroom, vroom, vrooming them or whatever it is, you know, and you're just modeling it and having other kids play along with you. Hopefully you'll get that quiet one vocalizing on some level by just doing those kind of repetitive, fun, action-filled activities where, you know, there's no wrong sound. Any sound is wonderful.
Right, and you need to act like that too, and you don't need to. And one thing that I think is so hard for moms is you think, okay, well, I want to get them to talk, so shouldn't I really be doing a lot of words in this? Sometimes the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you should really focus more on the sounds. And again, if you focus on having fun, and if your goal, you think, okay, all I want to do is have him make noise. I don't care what it is. I don't care that it's even close to a word. I just want him making noise. One other thing that I do during this is I think about what kind of sound can he do. You know, have I heard him blow a raspberry before, you know, the or whatever. Have I heard him do the Have I heard him, you know, kind of do you know, just any kind of, even a grunt. You use those and do those during that because, again, you could elicit something that he's done in another context. And you want to make those things that are reflexive or things that he's not even realizing that he's doing, you want to make those more purposeful. So you use those kinds of things during that too. If I've heard them sort of even accidentally babble or, you know, vocalize with a duh or a muh or a whatever, you know, that's, I might try to bring that sound or that vocalization into play too, because again, you want to help them make those things more consistent and more under their control. Because sometimes I think they're really even not. Sometimes you'll see a kid that they pop out a sound and it's like, whoa, where did that come from? You know, they're even surprised that they did it. So that's a good context to do that in. Cars do work great for that kind of thing because you can, you know, rum, rum, rum. There's all kinds of little sounds that you can do with that.
Right. What little boy doesn't love a car? Although I've had some girls love them, but I don't know I've ever had a little boy who didn't love them.
Me either.
Yeah.
Me either. The other thing that before you're ready to imitate lots of words that you want to try to get kids to do, sometimes kids can do sounds. much more easily than they can words. So, like animal sounds, and that happens to me frequently, Kate, that I'll get a new kid, you know, who's about to turn two, or I'll say, does he have any words? And Mom will say, well, does moo count? Does barking like a dog count? Does the pig?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely, it counts.
Counts in our book, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If I can transcribe it, I'm counting it as a word. So, you know, and again, sometimes kids are more, I think they're more willing to try to imitate those kinds of things because they're fun. There's no pressure with that. So that might be another activity to do when you're thinking, excuse me, about the whole vocal contagion piece, you know, playing with some farm animals. You know, again, and you're just sitting there not doing a lot of talking, you know, oh, Mommy has the cow and now I'm going to put him in the barn and now he's sleepy and he's going night-night. You can have those kinds of things, but really bring your words down, and the number of words that you use, and increase your sound so that you're going to do moo and walk, 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 or, you know, whatever you want to do for that, da, 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 da. And then have, are you still there?
I am, yeah.
Okay, good, because my computer screen went black, and I thought, oh, no, it's totally cut me off. Okay, sorry. But you want to use all those little vocalizations and all those little even animal sounds in play during that and see if you can't get some imitation going that way. If a kid still can't do that, if they're to the point that they like me imitating their sounds, but they still can't really imitate like an animal sound or a vehicle noise or something like that, I back up and take it just one little bitty step backwards and see if they can imitate some mouth movements that I do. And that might be blowing. You know, you could pretend like the cow's food is really, really hot. Ooh, the hay got too hot. Let's blow. And, you know, try to have them blow. You might pretend like the cow has a cold and he's going to sneeze and try to have, you know, your child imitate sneezing. Or you could do that even without the prop of an animal. The little guys that just finished up earlier this summer, Kate, did the whole achoo. You know,
yeah.
They both liked that fake cough and fake sneeze a lot. And they're the kind of kids, too, that once they could start imitating some of those little sounds, boy, their words really, a few months later, started to come on in. But we had to work really hard at that kind of silly play sound level for a long time.
Didn't seem to get the whole imitation thing until really that kind of clicked in. And once they got it, really, both of them had the ability to form and generate words, but they didn't really seem to get the imitation part, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Until we did a lot of that play sound stuff. I do smacking lips. That's one that kids will try to do sometimes. Even a little, you know, like I'm going to whisper, I'm going to tell a secret, telling a kid, doing that in a kid's ear. They think that is hysterical, and we'll try to kind of do that back in my ear sometimes. Anything, you know, just a big open mouth thing. Remember that little boy that we both saw too, Kate, that would try to imitate how you laughed?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the kid will pick up on something like that, and you think, gosh, I never would have gone there first to try to get them to imitate something. But sometimes those little facial things or things that you do with your mouth, even that aren't really words, really help build those imitative actions. One thing that I do all the time, and now after seeing me do it so much with all the footage that we film for the DVDs, is the whole mm-mm-mm-mm-mm thing.
Yeah.
I will hardly even let myself do that unless I'm kind of on automatic pilot in a session now. But that's something that really works with kids when you're having a snack, is to do, you know, put your lips together and the mm-mm-mm. And there's something about you shaking your shoulders with it and making it real big that makes the kid want to imitate that. I've had a lot of kids that are pretty low functioning start with that first, start to imitate that, because it is associated with something that you do all the time, eating, and it is pretty easy, a pretty easy sound to make. You know, just get your lips together to do that.
I've had a couple. I see one right now who I suspect could be a practic, and that was one of his few things he could do before I started was a mm-mm-mm. He likes to eat, too, so that was something he had lot of time to practice, and he could do that. Yeah.
Yeah, and you do have talk, Kate. I've got a bite of food in my mouth. Go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry. You do get lots of opportunities to practice that.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say. And you could probably hear me doing the eating sound right now. I'm so sorry. I'm never going to do that again.
I've also had a lot who did the num, num, num thing. You know, that's
right.
Another one seems to be kind of instinctive, even for kids who don't have words. Num, num, num. Mm-mm-mm. So they,
yeah.
You know, I guess, again, lots of practice, lots of food. Mommies must model that a lot or something, even if they're not even thinking about it. I think I did when my kids were babies. Num, num, num. You know,
yeah.
It kind of comes out. But
one thing I didn't talk about when we were talking about heightening the acoustics, you know, we were talking about being under the table. Sometimes using a bucket or a can is a lot of fun. Kids, you can just kind of yell into it, or ooh, or aha, and kids will try to do that.
Right. And I think elephant that way, too, because there's that motor in there, and if you just take the trunk off, and there's a little fan, so it kind of extorts, what's the word? Distorts your voice, and the fan's blown in their face, so that's kind of a fun little experience, and once we've done the elephant, you take the nose off to put them back in anyway. So I'll lean in and go, woo, or ee, or some funny. The other thing with voices is I try and remind myself to sometimes alter the pitch of my voice. Like, I'll say it like daddy, ha-choo, you know.
That's hysterical.
Well, it's like they think it's funnier, you know what I mean? Uh-huh. It just gets them a little bit more excited, a little bit more willing to try it. Or, you know, and then mommy's always, or baby, and I'll do a real squeaky little funny voice, you know, whatever it is. But it's somehow just altering it a little bit seems to sometimes make it easier for them, you know?
It does. Or, I sometimes wonder, is it just them because it makes them more likely to try?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If they think it's so funny that they want to do it that way. Snoring is...
Snoring, I was going to say, how many kids have you had that you could teach to snore?
Yeah.
They really... And that's part of the whole baby sleeping, daddy sleeping, whatever it is you have. The bear, the car. I mean, we make anything we play with sleep. It really doesn't matter. They're going to go night-night, and they're going to snore. And I usually work the...
Me too.
Night, night. And they'll try that. Sometimes it's way off, but, you know, I put my finger up there like I did to my kids when they were too loud and it was nap time, you know, and they'll try those things, and they just think it's hilarious.
They do, and, you know, you can sequence all that into what we would call a verbal routine so that you are practicing those same things over and over and over in a row. And, again, if you are fun enough, I hardly can find a toddler or a young preschooler who doesn't want to do it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so any toy that you have or even just you do the big, oh, I'm tired, I'm sleepy, and do a big stretch and a yawn and the, oh, you know, cover your mouth and do that and then say it's time for night-night, put your head down or put the thing down. I always do the shh as part of that. I always do pat, 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 and have the kid imitate me patting. And then I say, do you think we should wake him up and count, you know, one, two, three, and then wake up. Oh, and I forgot snore was in the middle of that.
Yeah, gotta get the snores in.
Yeah, but that's, you know, if you count every single piece of that, if the kid can imitate you yawning, and then put his head down like you're going to go night-night. Do the shh part. We're up to three things there. Do the snore. Imitate the pat, pat, pat. Sort of try to imitate you with counting, even if he's going, when you're going one, two, three, even if he's saying you know, he's still done that. That's up to six things. And then the big, wake up, wake up. You know, kids will usually just scream on that part. Ah! That's up to seven little things that you've had them sequence and do in one little play period. And sometimes in an hour visit, every darn toy, you know, at least in some part of the play, you know, you might do that 6 or 7 times in an hour. A lot of times kids are so into it, you know, you're doing it 35 times.
Sometimes I want to say, come on, night-night.
Yeah, balls don't go night-night. The ball is not going night-night. We're going to throw the ball. But you really, if you can extend that, and that's what, like, if you read the autism literature, like Dr. Greenspan's stuff, you know, he talks about opening and closing the circles of communication. You know, that's a kind of game or verbal routine you would want to do with a kid on the spectrum. When we look at apraxic kids, we're thinking about motor planning. You know, our colleagues that are PTs and OTs are thinking about, you know, the motor sequencing. Can they string lots of motor actions together? You know, as a speech pathologist, as the DI, we're looking at their play and at their verbalizations, how many different things can we do in a row and sequence together. You know, that's a great, great verbal routine to do, or play routine, because you've got 7 different actions or vocalizations for them to try to copy when they're doing that. And again, if you are fun enough, unless a child is very, very delayed cognitively, they are going to try to do at least part of that with you. And you might not introduce all 7 parts of that right away. You know, you just might do the whole night-night part and the shh and the wake up, and then you start to add the little pieces as you go and really build that. And don't you have kids, Kate, that initiate that with you?
Oh, yeah. The minute they see the daddy or the bed or the pillow or whatever it is, they're going right into the routine. Yeah. I always think, oh, we're going to do the night-night thing again. Yeah, I mean, they just, that's a fun one. And who's that? Giggle Time. Is it Saunders? Saunders?
Yes, Saunders.
She talks about if the importance of being able to gauge them in those social routines and how you it's easier, it's worthwhile to work communication into them. And I think her position is, 10 minutes. You need to be able to engage a kid in one of those routines or a variety of those routines, but at least for 10 minutes per routine. And, you know, in the beginning, it may be a minute. It may be
right.
30 seconds.
Yeah.
It may not even be a minute, but typically once kids get it and they know, oh, you know, you see their little light bulbs going off and they're, you know, oh, he knows what I'm going to do. And they like that routine and that predictability. You know, I mean,
right.
Think about kids, how many times they want to read the same book, how many times they want to play the same game, how many times they want to watch the same cartoon. They like that predictability. So if you build that into these vocalization games, it you know, works on many fronts, really.
Right, and you can make up your own. I mean, you know, we're just trying to give you some ideas, but sometimes I'll do a game with a kid, and then I'll think, gosh, that works so well, I'll try to duplicate that with another kid. Or you'll call me, you know, we at any given time will share maybe only 3 or 4 kids at a time, but you'll say, oh, listen to how I did this today, and I want to know exactly what you said and exactly what you did so that I can try to make that work. And then, you know, the next week I'll think, okay, what was that? What was that trick? What did Kate tell me that she worked with this kid so well? And then you might try to, like the Giggle Time lady talks about this, adding one more piece, but again, repeating it in the same way so that you do kind of build up to that. And it does get to the point where they initiate it, or they, even if they're not initiating it, you can see their little wheels turn or their eyes twinkle when you're getting ready to do that, because they do anticipate it and want to do it and want to participate in it. And it's fun for them because they know what to expect. Little hand motions to songs are the same way. You're building that, professionals would say, automaticity in, that automatic part where they know what's going to come next. And so music would be another way that you would want to do that. What are some songs you do with kids, Kate?
I do where is whatever a lot.
A lot, yeah.
A lot. Because I think it's predictable. It works on, you know, the comprehension. We're looking for something specific, and I make a big deal out and put my hands out. Where, oh, where is daddy? Where is the shoe? Where is whatever? I do Twinkle Twinkle quite a bit. If I'm doing animals, I do Old MacDonald some. I do Ride a Horsey if I'm doing the lap thing. think, what else? Some of them just come to me.
I know. I just have to kind of be in the situation and do it. I do all of those. If kids like to sing, if their moms and dads tell me that they like songs, I automatically include what, you know, what they like. I sing Wheels on the Bus quite a bit with kids.
Yeah, I do that one.
But like that, If You're Happy and You Know It, I do that one.
I do Row, Row Your Boat a fair amount.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah, me too. But those little hand motions, and again, it's just the repetition that they like and start to really know. And start to include, again, some little verbal pieces for them in that. Even if they're not words, just some things for them to do. You know, when we sing Row, Row Your Boat, we do the whole first part, and then the next part, you know, we do row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. If you see an alligator, close your eyes and scream. And we, with that, you know, we're doing the whole alligator. We put our arms out in front of us and, you know, do the open and close the mouth like you've made a big alligator mouth. And then close your eyes. We cover our eyes and do the scream. And rarely will I get a kid that can't and that won't start to imitate the ah! Scream at the end, and they think that's hysterical. And so that's a good one.
Yeah, that's a really good one. I do Ring Around the Rosie quite a bit.
Me too, yeah.
Again, if you're trying to get their little motors running, you want them moving, but with you, that's a good one. And if you have a group, that's a great one.
Yeah, I do that a lot of times with brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
And other things with Ring Around the Rosie, if kids really, really like it and they're again, no real cognitive issues or receptive language issues, I might change the words a little bit and do Run Around the Rosies, Pocket Full of Posies, Ashes, Ashes, All Fall Down. And we do different verbs at the beginning, tiptoe around the rosies, jump around the rosies, and kids think that's really, really funny to do that. And if you have a kid that won't fall, boy, I pretty much slam them down and have them do it so that they get that part. Or kids that fall too early, I pretty much drag them around until they say, no, not yet. Come on, ashes, you know, and get to that part. Ashes is a word that a lot of kids will try to imitate for Ring Around the Rosies. One thing, and the other thing that you do with these kinds of songs is after you've sung them and done them quite a bit, you need to pause and see if one of those little words will just kind of pop out. And down is one that kids will do.
An easy early one. I have a lot of kids get down pretty early. Remember those same little guys you referred to earlier, Laura? For a time, every time the one twin would see us, he'd start saying, ashes.
Like, I want to do Ring Around the Rosies. That's
he was
fun
reminding
that
us,
does
I have not
me.
Forgotten that ashes game. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, when you're doing like Ring Around the Rosies like that, you know, after you've done it like five or six times and they're getting ready to fall down, don't fall down until they say down, or at least try, you know, duh. You know, so you do ashes, we all fall, you know, and you're doing that build up, that anticipatory, and then say, tell me, you know, if they've said down before, you think that there's possibly a way for them to do it. You know, wait them out just a tad. You know, you can't wait 5 minutes and stand there and go, you got to say down before we fall. You know, but you can't extend it for 10 or 15 seconds. Come on, we all fall. You know, and then a lot of times they'll pop out, duh, or down, or, you know, something close to that, and then make a huge big deal about it and fall down with them and laugh and giggle. And then, you know, start all over. A lot of times with Ring Around the Rosies, I don't get up until a kid pulls me up or tells me up or does something. You know, I don't automatically. And this, once they love it and once they do it a lot, you know, I wait for them to initiate the game or want to play again, you know, either by grabbing my hands, and then sometimes I might sit on my hands and have them, you know, try to tell me or try to grab my hand up, and then, you know, pull me. I say, you have to tell Laura, tell me, up. And sometimes that'll kind of get that word going too. And it's fun because they want to play and they want to stay with you, and you've given them something to do that's not too hard. So that's another little verbal routine that I use a lot.
Right. And I think the verbal routine part, like she said, if you'll hesitate and give them a spot to fill in a simple word, because they've heard it so many times, and sometimes it takes a lot of times, of doing it.
Right.
You know, it might not be
like
the third.
500.
Or fifth, yeah. But, hey, it's something they can get pretty consistently, and it's a building point for, you know, if they don't have any words, it's pretty hard to build on nothing. So you got to get them something so that you can begin to build some kind of vocabulary for them. So the other
right.
one I do a fair amount, especially if I'm taking kids down a hallway, is that marching, marching, marching,
yeah.
marching. They like that because, again, there's some action, and I always think, well, we got to walk down the hallway anyway. Might as well
right.
do something verbal and some kind of movement. You know, a lot of kids seem to, you know, that does the same thing as ring around the rosy, basically. But it works well in hallways, I find.
And I hardly ever do it in halls. I don't know why we've never talked about you haven't shared that little tidbit with me, or I haven't gotten it. But that's a good thing, you know, kids that you're walking back to do it with. One other thing I wanted to say about this, and we're out of time, is you want to make sure that the word makes sense for them to do. Now, granted, we've already talked about the little boys that say ashes, ashes. That's not a word they would use in everyday conversation. But most of the time, try to stick to words that they would actually use. You know, row, row, row your boat. Boat would be, you know, a functional word for a young child to have, you know. And then the next line of the song is gently down the stream. Well, you know, you're not really going to say stream that much
no.
in normal everyday life. So you do want to try to get it with words that, again, you're building their vocabulary and it's going to kind of make sense to do. Sometimes parents will be so excited and when a kid is like singing ABCs, and I think that's great and everything, but when is he going to say G or element of P? And I think it's great just to get them to vocalize and just to get them to sing. And if you have a kid that's into that, that's fine. But try to have a lot of your songs be with words that they would actually make sense or that you could at least talk about when you're playing.
Right. And I don't want to lecture anybody who's listening who has a child who's language delayed. But I will just say, especially early on when words or any kind of word approximation is so rare, really, 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 really celebrate those early simple
mm-hmm.
sounds, those early efforts at some word, because, you know, it's so hard for them, and I do think it's so important that kids feel good about they tried, you know.
Something came out when I opened my mouth.
Yeah, sometimes I have parents who, you know, they really want them to say grandfather. They really want him to say motorcycle. They really want him to say, and I'm thinking motorcycle, you know.
You've got to be kidding me.
Yeah, I'd be thrilled with Mo right now.
Or bike,
so, yeah.
Yeah,
bike. That's what I always call him, really. I usually say bike, it's bike. Oh, motorbike. Motorbike,
right.
Bike. But because I think it's important that they do hear the real words occasionally, but if we're really targeting their expressive skills, it really has to be something that they have some chance of popping out.
Right.
And kids do not go from very quiet 2-3 words to helicopter. You know, it just really
yeah, they don't.
No.
Yeah.
So.
There's a whole lot of stuff in between there. And I love what you said, you know, really about praising them and celebrating their successes. Because the more feedback they get, the more motivated they are to want to try again. And it's some kids aren't natural performers and don't really respond to that. But most children really, really do like the whole yay and, you know, getting really excited about it. Sometimes I do it so much that I scare children.
Yeah.
You don't want to go overboard like that. But at the same time, you want them to know, boy, I am so proud of you. And again, you can't really say it with that. You know, it's got to be through a yay and a big hug or a tickle or whatever they like.
Right. And then
that's important.
I think if they feel like you're saying it's wonderful, because sometimes I do, gosh, I don't want to say that, but, you know, I do think they have some sense sometimes about it just is so hard for me and it doesn't come out right.
Yeah, and I'm not good enough, yeah.
Right. Daddy says basketball, I say ball, and he says, no, basketball. And, you know, that would be really disheartening to think I
yeah.
gave it my best shot. And I, you know, we all do those things inadvertently. But early on, I do think it's so important to just make a huge deal that they did anything. Because these are kids
yeah, I think so
who
too.
Don't really know how to control their voices, you know, even to yay or to squeal or to yell or whatever sound it might be. Some of them have that, and some kids who are practicing don't. But celebrate it, because it's going to encourage them the next time to let out their voice. And you know, they've got to be making noise before they can make some words. So
absolutely. You really don't go from quiet one day to talking the next. There's a whole lot in between there. You've got to be noisy in between.
Right. And, you know, like we talked about, these are quiet babies. And sometimes it's parents who might have a child who's apraxic first, and then they have another baby, and then they really begin to realize, whoa, he was quiet. Because
right.
they see how much noise typically developing babies make. They're constantly, you know, you're in the grocery store and you hear them. They're down the hall. They're making all these sounds, and mommy's cooing back and the baby's cooing back. And these kids just really didn't ever have any of that practice. So they almost have to start at that level, even if they're 18 months or 2 years old or whatever it is.
You're exactly right. I've got a family right now that I saw the two older sisters. And the first one is about 4, and I'm seeing the second one right now that's 2, and then they've had a new baby. And this is this mom and dad's first time with what I hope is going to be a baby with typically developing speech and language. And she is loud at 5 months, and they just cannot believe it because
right.
they've never, ever heard it before.
And,
yeah.
and, you know, unless you had spent a lot of time around babies, and lots of people don't until they really have them, you wouldn't really know, you know, and sometimes those kids might every once in a while make a sound or two, but typically developing kids really make sounds pretty
all
much
day.
The whole time they're awake, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, then they see it and they say, oh, I did not realize how much noise, you know,
right.
the difference between typically developing.
Normal and not normal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So.
You're right. Okay, well, that wraps up another show. Thanks, Kate.
Thank you. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye.
Bye.